crying, were crying, crying when I saw her smile. She got a toothbrush in her back pocket.
And that was Otis Taylor, Hungry People. And tip of the hat to Skidmark Bob for putting that in a special collection for me to conveniently play here on Free Radio, which is what you're tuned to. We're either coming at you on the computer at www.freakradio.org, or possibly you're listening to us at 101.1 FM on your radio dial. Or maybe you're listening to a show that you've downloaded that is from a long-ago time at this point on the Huff website, because that's where these shows are archived, www.huffsantacruz.org. Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, concerns itself with civil rights for homeless people and the quest for those rights, the attempt to block, stop, overturn, and nullify anti-homeless laws that essentially make it illegal to be homeless, and are an attempt by some groups to purge the homeless from our community and indeed from the nation. So, actually, we're going to be having an interesting guest on. You've heard him before. He's an activist in Fresno. His name is Mike Rhodes. He actually almost single-handedly got together the initial impetus for the Fresno Kincaid successful lawsuit that stopped Fresno police and Caltrans authorities from seizing homeless property, arresting people for sleeping or putting up tents. And indeed, he and the attorneys that he was able to gather together through his photographic evidence of police harassment, $2.3 million for homeless folks, which is actually probably one of the largest settlements homeless people have ever had, if not the largest, although it doesn't, of course, solve the problem of homelessness, even in Fresno. In fact, that amount of money was available last year to the mayor's office, maybe slightly more, but the mayor chose not to use it because, who wants to spend money on those homeless bums, right? Anyway, Mike is going to be talking about what's going on in Fresno around homeless issues and some other issues. That'll be around 7 o'clock tonight, so stay tuned. In about an hour, that's going to happen. Also happening at 7 tonight is an event at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which I actually heard about directly from some of the people who are putting it on. And you can find out more about that event by going to Santa Cruz Indie Media, or actually indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, indybay.org/Santa Cruz, all small letters, all one word, where there's a lot of different local events mentioned, and then some of the protests that Huff and I are involved in. You can find me and my descriptions of what's going on with those particular protests on the right side of the screen on the Santa Cruz Indie Media website. The thing that's happening tonight at 7 o'clock, according to the calendar, which is at the top of the website, is Proposition 1 Grassroots Anti-Nuke Event. In fact, they may be calling in to talk about that. I've invited them to do that. This is happening at 515 Broadway. Ellen Thomas will be here, that is to say at 515 Broadway, the Resource Center for Nonviolence, to talk about Proposition 1, a grassroots effort to get a nuclear ban on the ballot. It's a promise from the United States to the world that we will get rid of all our nuclear weapons if everyone else does, and we'll use the money instead to convert the war machines to provide for human needs, especially alternative energy industries. Nobody loses on Proposition 1. Those who are currently employed in the defense industries, the blurb goes, will be able to keep on working at the cutting edge of the clean energy age. Those who are trained to work with radioactive materials can help with the cleanup, and scientists can do research on the neutralization of radiation. You will see parts of a video narrated by a former nuclear weapons builder, Dr. Ted Taylor. You will hear about where legislation is currently and the help that is needed. Please join us. Again, 7 o'clock, Resource Center for Nonviolence, 515 Broadway, in about 45 minutes, more or less. So check that out if you'd like. And we may hear more from them by somebody calling in for Proposition 1, which I actually heard about 20 years ago. It's a long-standing attempt to establish, I think, a national initiative. There is no such thing as a national initiative process, of course, but at least not in terms of the law system we have currently. In some states, California and other individual states, do have state initiative processes. Santa Cruz has a city initiative process that can be done, but there is no national initiative, which doesn't mean that isn't a good idea. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. It's just, to me, a little discouraging to look at 20 years later and one sees the same thing. Of course, the same thing is true with the kinds of local civil rights concerns I have, like the sleeping ban law that criminalizes homeless people after 11 o'clock at night in Santa Cruz, in a city that has zero shelter, at least zero emergency walk-in shelter. You can get on waiting lists, and somewhere down the road you might get into the Paul Lee loft, you might get into the Rebel Lee family shelter if you're in a family, or you might get, if you are diagnosed, dual diagnosis, or referred from the county, or get into one of the other narrow slots of the River Street shelter for a month, or you might get into transitional housing at the Page Smith Community House. All these are different buildings at the Homeless Service Center at 115 Coral Street, the highway intersections of Highway 9 and Highway 1, safely away from the downtown area. But in the meantime, kick out 50 cents for every meal you spend out there. Unless, of course, you're already a part of these shelter programs, in which case apparently you don't have to pay for those meals. We've gotten some criticisms of what's going on out of the Homeless Service Center recently from different homeless clients who are baffled and enraged by the bureaucracy out there. And indeed, I've had on the show Doug Loisel, who's the Homeless Service Center Executive Director, and hopefully I'll have him back again, and we can talk some more about this issue. But in any case, 7 o'clock tonight, Grassroots Anti-Nuke event, Proposition 1 initiative at the Resource Center for Inaction. I'm sorry, for Nonviolence. I'm an old critic of the Resource Center for Nonviolence, as they call it, because while they often do host some good stuff in terms of national issues, and even locally, I know, you know, Free Radio Santa Cruz Collective meets there occasionally with its closed meetings. But in terms of the resource centers taking a stand on local issues that concern the civil rights of local people, that just doesn't happen much, at least not if they want to challenge the likes of Scott Kennedy or Mike Rotkin or Mayor Cynthia Matthews. They just don't do that at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Hence, I've called them the Resource Center for Inaction. But that doesn't mean they're inactive on all fronts. You might want to look into this event tonight. I'm going to go back now to street interviews, which I do a lot of on the show, and you can judge for yourself if they're of interest to you. You can give a call in to the call-in number here. I think it's working. It was working earlier this afternoon. 427-3772. 427-3772 is the number. And there's an alternate number, 469-3119. 469-3119. You can find these numbers if you go online to the Free Radio Santa Cruz website, www.freakradio.org, freakradio.org, and you can download applications there, get a lot of information about the station, schedules, and so forth. Here's some archived shows of different kinds, and make donations. And we're always up for donations. Give us money, please. Equipment, offer your commentary and thoughts. There's a commentary going, some controversy in the station these days about Spanish language programming, how much of it to have, when and where. Es necesario obtener mucha información de los que hablan español. I'd like to get information for those who speak Spanish as well. ¿Quieres más en español en la estación de Radio Freak Radio? O hay bastante en otras estaciones? ¿O cuál es el mejor? The best road to serving both the Spanish and English speaking audience. Para ellos que hablan español y ellos que hablan inglés, ¿cuál es la mejor cosa para hacer para las dos lenguas en esta estación? It's hard for me to speak Spanish. Es difícil hablar español, so I'm not going to do this much longer. And most of my audience, I think, is primarily English speaking. La mayoría de mi de ellos que de oír mi hablando es habla inglés. Most of you are English speaking out there, and so I do put this mostly in English. But you know, we are in a bilingual community, and it's sad to see things ghettoed off into different areas. Es importante para ellos que hablen inglés, ellos que hablen español, habla a la una a la otra, that people talk to each other, and that we realize, particularly those of us who are poor, los pobres especialmente, that it's a common struggle. Es una huelga, es una cosa importante hacer juntos. Do we have to do this together? And it's hard to figure out how to do that. I guess they did it in New York City, in la ciudad de Nueva York, hace muchos años. Hay muchas lenguas diferentes. There were many different languages and different cultural groups, grupos, culturas, that were drawn together and got stronger. Más solidaridad. They had a lot of solidarity, and as a consequence, they were able to get some political power, which I think is important. We don't have rent control in Santa Cruz. Nosotros pagamos demasiado para vivir en cuartos. We pay too much money to live here. The wages are too low. Ellos pagan los trabajadores demasiado pequeño de dinero. And I speak too little Spanish. So I'm going to leave it at that and turn now to the street interviews. But these are issues coming up on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And if you want to weigh in on them, llámame, call me up. It's 427-372-4772. So let's get on with the street interviews, and they will not be translated into Spanish unless somebody comes into the studio who speaks Spanish faster and better than I do, but hang with me anyway. Well, it's about 12:20 on August 26th, Wednesday, a sunny Wednesday, after the Huff meeting here at Spruce and Pacific in front of Sub Rosa. We're talking with
Lawrence McGregor.
And Lawrence, you came into the Huff meeting, and you had some news about a strange camping ticket you received in the park one morning.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about that.
It was an officer came in. Said they had a complaint for people sleeping in the park. I wasn't sleeping. I was laying on my top of my sleeping bag, and he gave me a ticket for sleeping in the park.
Now, so what were you doing as he approached you?
Laying on my sleeping bag and playing video games.
What video games?
Tetris and bowling.
And there were other people with you?
Yeah, I had four other witnesses. We're in
Ariel,
Taz, Scott or Steve, I don't remember his name. One other person, I'm not really positive.
Were they two criminally sleeping in the park?
No, they're sitting with me in the park, and I got harassed by this cop.
Which park are we talking about?
Are
you talking about Loudon Nelson or Laurel Park?
Loudon Nelson.
And what time of day was it?
It was like 10:30, 11 o'clock.
So the ticket that the officer wrote you says 8:15.
But it wasn't 8:15. I had witnesses. They were already getting ready for the NA meeting in the afternoon when the cop came up harassing me.
This was on August 5th?
Yes, sir.
Day, of course, is August 26th, so that was about 3 weeks ago at least. Had you seen this officer before?
No, sir.
And that's Your Majesty, if you don't mind. Or His Worship, perhaps, or Your Greatness. Well, sorry. So Lawrence, you should be aware that these citations don't hit court for about a month at least. Have you gotten any previous sleeping tickets?
Yes.
And what has been your reaction to those?
You can take them or you eat them.
Now, but are they good to eat? Do you feel like satisfied after a meal of sleeping van tickets?
No.
You mean you're still hungry?
Yes.
Doesn't it, in fact, make you a little sick?
I'm sick of cops harassing people for sleeping or just laying on their blankets.
Had the police officer offer you a legal place to go?
No.
But he said there'd been a complaint.
Yes.
Did you say who was complaining?
No.
And I notice your left arm is is bandaged up. What's that about?
Hitchhiking from New Mexico. Got my wrist shattered from a driver just drove right by and made a stop.
So he hit you with his. Did you hit the car? Did the car hit you?
The car hit me.
See, did he swerve out of his way, or did you attempt to stop the car with a kind of a Superman-like gesture?
No, I just put my thumb out And he just plowed right into my hand, and my hand shattered.
Well, did you place your hand in front of the moving car, or did the moving car move over to get your hand?
I don't know. It was in the day.
You clumsy oaf, you! Well, in any case, how long ago was this?
About 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago.
So, but the officer seeing your hand bandaged up, it looks like your wrist and hand are bandaged. That's your right hand. That's your left hand.
Left hand.
Are you left-handed?
Yes, sir.
So you told him so you had to sign the ticket with your right hand.
Right, sir.
Did he have any other advice or instructions or warnings for you?
Yeah, if I need to sleep somewhere, get out of town. But disabled person like me, I'm a veteran, and I can't hitchhike or walk that far to get out of town.
So what service were you in?
Air Force.
And how long were you in the Air Force, and where did you get sent?
I was in for 8 years, first Gulf War, and the second Gulf.
And here you are in Santa Cruz in the sleeping van war.
Yes, sir.
Now, I wonder about I wonder about the amount of time in the service, because the first Gulf War was 1990-91. And the second Gulf War was 2003, and he was in the service for 8 years. So there seems to be a discrepancy there. This is in the interest of full disclosure. It sounds like there's either an arithmetic problem, a factual problem, or some other confusion here. Perhaps I don't understand what he's trying to describe here in terms of his alleged Air Force service.
Is there any chance of, I don't know, some kind of helicopter surveillance with the police?
Maybe, because they've been cleaning out the levee a lot lately and scaring everyone out, arresting them, or just giving them tickets for sleeping on the levee.
So, actually, I was more of a sort of a whimsical statement suggesting that you might be able to sort of round up a helicopter and keep an eye on the police.
I could, if I wanted to.
Can you drive a helicopter?
Yes.
Well, then we expect you in the future to, you know, try to take some moves in this direction, Lawrence.
Right.
Anything else you want to say about this? Any harassment in the last 3 weeks? You've been outside for the last 3 weeks, right?
Yes, sir.
And you haven't gotten any citations since then?
No.
Have police passed you by?
Yeah, they look at me, they stare at me, trying to figure out if I'm going to leave town or not.
And where do they usually, do you sleep in the same place?
Yes, sir.
Do you wish to reveal your secret location or not?
No.
All right, well, we will have to send a police officer around to make sure that you don't disturb the flowers.
Yes, sir.
We've been talking with?
Lawrence McGregor.
Thanks, Lawrence.
You're welcome.
So we're kind of wandering in the courtyard of the bike church, and we're talking with?
Andrew Pappin.
Andrew, you're a man who's been keeping an eye, volunteering for the Sub Rosa. It looks like you're also a student, and but you also observed stuff over in San Lorenzo Park that's concerned you.
Yeah, so I'm a member of the bowling club over there, and I just noticed that some of the members...
Lawn bowling?
The lawn bowling club, and they have a number on one of their boards, like, to call a police officer. I was like, that worried me right away. And I noticed that one of the people they were talking about, that they call them anytime they want to get the homeless people away from their park. And it seems like the effect
is because the homeless people are throwing lawn bowls at them, ripping up
no,
the grass.
No, they're doing nothing.
We pee-peeing on the...
They're just laying on blankets, eating food. That's about it. That's all I can see.
It can be very distracting.
It is for some people. Yeah. So I even see they're going to try to do it at this tournament that's coming up in like a week or so. And they're already expecting it to happen. They're going to call the police, it sounds like, and then try to...
So it could be a nice time for a protest. When is this tournament, anyway?
So the tournament is, I don't know the exact, I think September 4th or something starting, and then it goes for like a week.
Give me a call. Let me know about it. I'll keep my card.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just trying to figure out what I should do when the police ever try to do this to them.
And I suggested you things like have a video camera or an audio camera or just, maybe a cell phone or look like you do. Or maybe comment loudly to someone else, I wonder why the police are moving away people, I wonder what they're doing wrong. And you can also, if someone is being written a citation, you can ask the person whose for whom the citation is being written what it's for. The cop won't tell you, but the guy can. And if the guy doesn't know, you direct the guy. You ask him. Ask the police officer what you're being given a ticket for.
Yeah. Okay.
You know.
So sometimes I'm thinking that they're just asking and hoping that they're using, you know, their police presence to get him away.
Right.
And maybe it does. They just move, you know,
which
20 meters
works.
So I just want to know, like. Yeah, I just want
to... Another option would be to get a huge fire hose and start hosing the police.
Okay, I probably won't be doing that, but...
No, I probably wouldn't. Although, it's a way to clean up the area.
Maybe.
So, how many times have you seen this happen?
Well, so I'm new to the club, so this is just all new to me. So, I've just seen it was effective once, where they were there, and then they were gone, and like...
How many people were told, were
gone? It was probably like maybe six or seven that they were there, and then they were completely gone. I just didn't see them as a... And, like, within, like, an hour, they were all gone. So something, either one of the members went out there and told them to leave, and they did. I'm not sure if that was happened, or a police officer came.
Perhaps they moved to their own accord.
Yeah, which is possible.
He's trying to always attack our police department, eh?
Probably.
We've been talking with?
Andrew Pappen.
Thank you, Andrew.
No problem.
So we have another account here. We're actually on the sidewalk away from the Sub Rosa Cafe, because Sub Rosa still has not made a decision regarding... Although apparently it's getting closer to making a decision about allowing audio recordings between people who are consenting adults.
Consenting adults being operant time.
But, Moo, we have you, flautist extraordinaire, with a story of some sort.
Not only loitering, but a bigger interest is my daughter's show business career, Jasmine Lepore. I think made some bad choices as to who to trust in City of Angels, and now is herself an angel, having, I don't know what to say exactly.
She got bumped off?
Killed in a cheap motel.
How long ago?
This is last Monday.
Jeez, I'm sorry to hear that, Mo.
She danced under the name April Vaughn. She was known in the paper as Jasmine Fiore, which... No connection to me, and in 10-15 years we were together, I never saw her be the least bit angry or violent with me, nor I with her, so I always felt like she was a little too...
Well, she, how did she die? What was the...
circumstance? She was murdered by her ex-boyfriend, lover, a guy from Canada, supposedly...
And how does this relate to police abuse? What's the significance of it?
No connection in that my daughter's story will be on TV tonight at 7 at 10.
So just sort of a tragic bunch of horseshit, pretty much.
You probably knew her when she was 8 or 10 years old.
Oh, you were around town with her?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So this is a former Santa Cruz resident who's no longer with us.
Former Bonnie Dean resident, former Felton resident. And
right.
Boulder Creek, probably 7 or 8 years of her life also. So it's kind of late-breaking local news. And I felt it coming about a month ago because I was having all kinds of really bad thoughts about her and myself and death and violence. And so...
You had a premonition.
I had a very clear premonition that she was in trouble or somebody was in trouble. Hey, we were also experiencing fires, so I was thinking of... the mountains that she and I love just going up in flames. So maybe that was part of it.
Well, Moo, I didn't know. I don't remember. You know, Jasmine actually rings a bell. I might actually have I might have. She might have been actually mentioned in the street shit sheet in years past, you know, in earlier editions. How old was she when she died?
28.
So this was 20 years ago.
She probably actually wasn't around here much after she was 20 or 22 years old.
Right, so but until then she was around.
Oh, hell yes. She was a local kid, went to local schools, played volleyball, had her horses and ponies, lived in the mountains.
Died in Los Angeles.
And died in the sleazy business of so-called reality TV.
Well, thank you, Moo. And
you're my media representative. You know more about this stuff than I do. And I felt like for years reality TV was you get $10,000 if you can swallow 100 crickets while jumping on one leg. And as far as I'm concerned, she probably could have excelled at that kind of reality TV. And I hope nothing bad would happen.
All right, Moo. I will pass this on to... folks who are listening.
Hang on to it for now.
And we have a caller calling in about the event tonight in Santa Cruz. Hi there, caller.
Well, hello.
Hi, what's your name?
I'm Jay Marks from Washington, D.C., and I work with the Proposition 1 Committee. And we're on tour to bring nuclear disarmament to the ballot everywhere we can. We think now's our chance to get, you know, we've got a president who clearly wants nuclear disarmament, and now all we have to do is overcome the entire military nuclear industrial complex.
Don't you have a president who's pushed the biggest military budget in history and is escalating a war in Afghanistan that even Bush wouldn't escalate? I mean, let's be honest about this.
Well, we have that, too, and that is a problem. And as we see so often, the rhetoric differs from the reality. But we kind of figure that it's up to us in the end. If and when we're going to decide this is still a democracy, then it's up to us to use really our people power, and including our petition power, to make our politicians uphold their own rhetoric.
For sure, but would you have used the same kind of gentle tone with Bush that you're using with Obama? I mean, I find it a little, frankly, unpersuasive. It reminds me of what the Democratic Party generally and former peace activists, so used to be peace activists, but have apparently shut up and laid down and gone to sleep or during around Obama. I mean, here's a guy who, as I said, spending more money than Bush on the military budget. He isn't withdrawing substantially from Iraq. He's bombing people in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and he hasn't got any serious proposals around.
You know, you're right about that. Although there is at least been the drawdown in Iraq, but not to be in a
very minor drawdown.
Agreed, and without a doubt, he's got to do more. But what's he really going to do? I mean, you're right. The war movement has rolled over and gone to sleep.
Well, you are the anti-war. Wait a minute, Jay. You're the anti-war movement talking right now. You are. You know. I mean,
you better be more than me.
You're the one who's calling the radio station. You're the one who's publicizing an event tonight at the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 7 o'clock. By the way, for those who want to go to it, I've already mentioned it on the air. By the way, briefly. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Proposition 1? And I'm giving you a hard time because I don't like people who soft soap this thing with Obama. Obama is, as far as I'm concerned, an even more treacherous and dangerous war criminal than Bush because he doesn't even have Democratic opposition of any meaningful kind.
Well, we know that Bush was a special case, and we've had an interregnum of 8 years of idiocy, stupidity, and ugliness. And there's this hope or dream that springs eternal, especially in the mindset of those who think that one of the two corporate parties might step up and actually create peace.
Yeah, but what's the point of what's the point of encouraging that kind of mindset? You may have had 8 years of Bush, but you've had 8 months of Obama or more, and you know what you're getting now, don't you?
But we've got to be realistic about what any president
for sure
can do in 8 months, right?
Oh, I mean, come on.
We have to set the table and give him a chance.
Okay, so you are defending Obama. I'm really sorry to hear that. This is the same crap I'm hearing from a lot of other people.
Now look.
You've got to give him a chance.
One chance Obama just had is the restart treaty, right? The START treaty expires in December. This is what Reagan and Gorbachev, and credit, frankly, to Gorbachev for making it happen back in the late 80s. And now it expires. And now here Obama and Medvedev have a chance to make, you know, acute cuts, and they're cutting something like 25 warheads from our 3,000 warhead arsenal, 3,000 plus on alert warhead in the arsenal, not counting the 2,500 plus others that are waiting and could be made ready within hours. And we know that here's a chance for Obama to step right up and lead. And what has he done? He's, you know, kind of soft pedaling, just extending the treaty and nothing more.
Yeah, but I'll have to say, wait, let me be devil's advocate here and say, gee, you've got to give Obama a chance. Why don't we just, you know, realize we've had 8 years of Bush. Let's give Obama some more time, shall we?
Well, okay, look, the time is right now. And we're on the Proposition 1 in 2010 campaign because we believe if every state in the country or the states that have initiatives, which are mostly on the west side of the country, stepped up and put nuclear disarmament on the ballot as citizen initiatives, the same way we did in Washington, D.C. back in 1993, then we could really get results. Because in 93, we passed nuclear disarmament and economic conversion, spending the right now about $52 billion a year on nuclear weapons and converting that spending, changing it, transforming the nuclear industrial complex and making things that are useful and peaceful. I.e. renewable energy.
No, wait a minute. Are you suggesting that there was a truly meaningful change under Clinton in 1993? Are you talking about...
Only on a local level. Nationally, we know that... well, actually, it's very interesting. The political and social climate right now is very similar to 1993. A lot of high hopes when Bill Clinton came into office, right? A lot of Bush and Reagan fatigue that everybody thought Clinton was going to come down from Camelot and make it all better.
Hauntingly familiar.
We learned the hard way. You know, so many people want to hope that we might see better under Obama. Experience teaches us otherwise, unless, and here's the key, unless there actually is a citizens' movement. Obama famously likes to quote FDR. He quotes Roosevelt and says, all right, you've convinced me, now go out there and put some pressure on me. And
yeah,
so the
yeah.
idea behind Proposition 1 is it's up to us, the citizens, to put the pressure on.
So tell us exactly, Jay, what exactly is Proposition 1 for those who don't know?
Okay, so Proposition 1 is essentially two things. It's fundamentally a blanket term, like an umbrella term, for any citizen initiative for nuclear disarmament and economic conversion. Right? So in our case in Washington, D.C., in 1993, it was Initiative 37, which was passed by 56% of the voters. And as a result, there's now another iteration of Proposition 1 is the Nuclear Disarmament and Economic Conversion Act. And Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's our representative, excuse me, our delegate in D.C., we don't have an actual voting representative in Congress, but our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, has submitted that bill every session of Congress since it passed in 1992, 9 times now. And so that bill exists. This year it's H.R. 1653. And I don't know who your congressman is here in Santa Cruz. I trust that you
It's a Representative Sam Farr, who voted for the biggest war budget in history, the Obama budget, about a month ago.
Now, when you say the war budget, are we talking? You're talking about just the war supplemental, or the entire massive?
I'm talking about the entire so-called Defense Department budget that has nothing to do with defense.
Right. The offense budget.
Right.
Of which nuclear weapons are a $52 billion a year part of.
So
that's one place to start. That's almost 10% of our entire military budget. Although, don't be confused. You won't find a lot of the military budget, you won't find a lot of the nuclear budget under the military, because all our nuclear weapons are actually owned by the Department of Energy. So if you're trying to figure out how much we're spending each year on nuclear weapons, you have to look at two-thirds of the budget of the Department of Energy, which actually owns and is responsible for securing and cleaning up not only the development but the deployment of our nuclear weapons. Right? So you've got to factor all that in. But that's the fundamental of Proposition 1, is citizen initiative and the vote for nuclear disarmament, get rid of the nuclear weapons complex, and economic conversion. Spend that money on peaceful pursuits, starting with environmental restoration and renewable fuel. And as Ellen Thomas, who's speaking tonight here at the Social Justice Center, right here on the corner of Ocean and Broadway. And
515 Broadway, actually.
Almost downtown. That's right. Two houses up from the corner. Thank you.
Yeah.
But Ellen spent 18 years in front of the White House. Her husband, William Thomas, founded a vigil in front of the White House. He sat down in 1981, just at the beginning of Reagan's term, with a sign that said, "Wanted, wisdom and honesty," and did not depart for 27 years.
Now, is this the Creative Community for Nonviolence vigil or another one?
Well, it's interesting you ask, because, of course, the Community for Creative Nonviolence, which actually is the largest homeless shelter on the East Coast now, that came into being in a very powerful way through citizens' movement of the homeless, back right around the same time. But and many of the people who did work on that also were part of Proposition 1 over the time. You know, things have shifted in D.C. since the early 80s, but at that time there was a little more tolerance of the homeless population. The story of the Community for Creative Nonviolence is very inspiring. Mitch Snyder and the folks who organized there in D.C. to actually take over unused government building and turn it into the homeless shelter that it remains today is incredibly inspiring. But that's one thing Proposition 1 managed to do, is tap into the energy and dedication of the homeless and bring them into the fold and engage them on the nuclear disarmament issue. So it's not the same vigil, but, you know, obviously there's some back and forth. And some
we know that when women protested Wilson's going to war in World War One, they were beaten and starved and jailed. Whereas, I guess, protesters that are like Cindy Sheehan or Martha's Vineyard,
That's
Massachusetts,
right.
trying to bring the issue forward of, you know, Obama's a vacation retreat, having, you know, she was at Crawford, Texas when Bush was down there. Now
right.
she's trying to follow Obama. And, of course, the media is doing a complete blackout or a large blackout.
That's what I wondered. Truth is, I hadn't heard anything. What kind of success has she had in Martha's Vineyard?
It's a good question. I've just noticed, you know, one thing I read recently, I think I saw a couple days ago something on Democracy Now, which you probably follow. And or many of those who listen to this station follow. And there's also a couple of articles, or at least one article on Counterpunch. And she has her own website. If those who are interested in finding out what Cindy Sheehan is up to, just Google for Cindy Sheehan, you'll find her website. And I think I will try to do that later. We're talking with Jay of Proposition 1, which is, you're trying to get
nuclear disarmament and economic conversion on the ballot in every jurisdiction possible. So
okay.
Here in California, of course, California is famous around the country for its statewide initiative. And you know, a lot of times conservatives are better at pushing initiatives than progressives and liberals are.
Have you had any success with conservatives on this issue? I know there are some conservatives years ago, you know, paleo-conservatives, we used to call them followers of Taft and so forth back in the 40s and 50s, who actually were opponents of intervention. Some of them still are, if you go to antiwar.org.
Well, that's true, and then there's this gang of four, right? Sam Nunn and Henry Kissinger, and he on the board of Bechtel, George Shultz, and I forget Admiral. There's another Admiral, but these are four known conservatives who a few years ago came out for nuclear disarmament, and of course, progressives are justly suspicious of these guys, you know, cold warriors coming out for nuclear disarmament. But of course, since the U.S. has such a vast advantage in conventional arms, and that's one of the problems that you get into when you get deep into the disarmament debate and you get into the hows and wherefores of it, you realize that a lot of the countries of the world are not necessarily in such a hurry for nuclear disarmament. They think it's keeping them safe while the U.S. maintains this massive conventional arms force.
You know, I think you're not going to find too many people listening to the station, perhaps a few, who are going to speak up for more nuclear weapons or even the continued and current level of nuclear megadeth that we're, you know, backing and, you know, our homes are being foreclosed on for.
Right.
But the question is, what can people in Santa Cruz do? Do you have any? I know you're in Washington, D.C., right?
Proposition 1 is based in Washington, D.C.
I'm sorry. Are you calling from Washington, Jay, or are you calling locally here?
I am calling from the corner, across the street from 515 515 Broadway.
You're right outside the building where where Ellen Thompson's going to be speaking at 7 o'clock, right?
Ellen Thomas will speak
Thomas,
at 7,
sorry.
And hopefully some other folks from WILT, you mentioned, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom.
Right on.
Also endorsed this event. We spoke last night in Berkeley at Redwood Gardens. Again, the women of WILT, which, as you mentioned, was back doing arms control and disarmament back during World War I. WILT is a 94-year-old organization. There's some other organizations that we're with. Ellen is actually on the Disarm Committee. She's one of the co-chairs of the Disarm Committee for WILT. And people may not know that WILT maintains an office right across the street from the UN. And they run their Reaching Critical Will program. Right?
This is in Washington, D.C. you're talking about.
I'm talking about in New York City,
right across
the street from the United
Sorry
Nations,
mm-hmm.
where they've got this, they've got an office overlooking, along with several other, you know, progressive or religious or based organizations.
Well, what can people
keep an eye out on the UN? And one of the things that I just want to share one more thing real quick before we have to go in. It's getting towards 7 and we want to get ready. And of course, all your listeners are even now jumping on their bike.
Even now, man. Even now.
Dipping down to the Center for Nonviolence here, Resource Center for Nonviolence, which I've got to say, as a former coordinator of the Washington Peace Center, the Peace Center you all have here in San Francisco is beautiful.
We're in Santa Cruz, but right on.
Did I just say San Francisco?
It's okay. Yes, where you came from, probably.
That's right. We did just come.
But let me just ask you one question, Jay, because I know you got to go in quickly. What can people in Santa Cruz specifically do? Have you talked to any local organizers about, you know, maybe setting up a local initiative? Have you talked about, you know, having the Board of Supervisors pass a resolution? Or I guess you have
exactly
mentioned...
Exactly it.
Right. Well,
hitting the options. We've talked to the people here at the center and some other folks tonight. I think the key, of course, is follow up. Mm-hmm. We're going to have, you know, a good solid crew of arch dedicated anti-nuclear folk who come out tonight to hear what we've been doing and what we can do. Our goal is to be a sort of a lightning rod, if we can be, and just plant the seeds, plant the idea, and say to people, you know, here you are. You're the ones who live in Santa Cruz. Imagine what, how many of your tax dollars that could be being spent on human needs locally could be putting solar panels on roofs, could be building wind turbines, could be local transportation, what have you. Imagine what your cut of the nuclear budget, just $52 billion a year. And if you think about how much we spend on nuclear weapons since we started, since the Manhattan Project starts in 1942, you're looking at between $7 and $8 trillion.
How can people get involved who can't make it to this event at 7 o'clock at 515 Broadway?
They can give us a call, for one. Our number, I can just lay it out, is 202-210-3886. That's the cell phone. You can talk to us at any time. And but
you
also
got,
you can go to our website.
Yeah, go
yes,
ahead.
Yes, sir, and that's www.prop1.org. Prop 1, short for proposition, so P-R-O-P, numeral 1. And you can also follow our adventures online. We're posting on the blog, and that's a long one. It's www.proposition1in2010. Proposition O-N-E-I-N 2010. .blogspot.org. What, 2010, 2010. Right, so that's the story, and, you know, we hope people can make it out, and more importantly, we hope people can believe that, you know, devil's advocacy notwithstanding, it is up to us to force our politicians, our so-called leaders, to execute their rhetoric, and it's up to us to create the grassroots movement that will lead the world towards nuclear disarmament.
Let me know when you take over a few buildings or start dismantling a few warheads.
All right, Robert. Well, we're going to meet some folks. We've met incredible activists along the way, including we were just down at Vandenberg Air Force Base just north of Santa Barbara with Father Louis Vital, who is a Franciscan monk who has been in the forefront of the anti-war movement for a long time, and a woman named McGregor Eddy out of Salinas, who is another WILP woman who has been really watchdogging and monitoring Vandenberg, where they just lobbed another Minuteman missile, you know, without the warheads, and sent it off to the Marshall Islands, as if we haven't done enough to the Marshall Islands with the scores of nuclear tests that we did back in the 50s.
Well, Jay, keep us informed. And, again, if you want more information, you can check this thing out at 7 o'clock at 515 Broadway at the Resource Center, or you can go to www.prop1.org. Thank you, Jay, and good luck tonight.
Robert, thanks for the time and appreciate it.
All right, man.
Yo, Santa Cruz, thank you. Peace out.
And phone lines are open. 427-3772 is the call-in number. It is about 15 to 7, so if you want to turn off your radio and hustle down to check out the Resource Center event, feel free to do that. I'm always wondering what the local ramifications are. I mean, when will Rotkin, who will never stop, he's our vice mayor, you know, well, I actually haven't heard him talking a lot about nuclear disarmament, but I'm sure he's one who will give lip service to that, just as I do. But when it comes to, let's say, researching firms that may be profiteering off of the Iraq, Afghan, Pakistan wars, such as Camp Dresser and McKee overseas, he wants to put $2 million into that for a desal plant and more consultant studies in Santa Cruz. I found myself wondering, you know, what the hell's going on? Do actions and words mesh? Or what's happening with the issue of what kind of money is actually being put into firms that conceivably are profiteering off military ventures? I mean, and what other kinds of actions can local city councils take that might have some significant effect, like supporting people who don't go to this war? Although we don't have a draft, you know, we have people who have decided they want to turn away from this. They had been in the National Guard. They wanted some information on how to get out of the mess they've gotten into. Stop loss kinds of compulsory services. There is, I think there are things our local government can do that they're not doing, and that we need to either hold them to do or throw them out in order to really do something more than make abstract statements about how we'd like to see nuclear disarmament, you know. Which I've got nothing against abstract statements per se, but unless you follow that up with concrete actions, it doesn't mean much, in my view. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. Name of the show is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. And what have I got here? I got coming up at 7, we're going to have Mike Rhodes on from Fresno. Mike has talked a lot about and actually worked a lot on issues of homeless civil rights and other progressive issues in Fresno where progressive means things, well, has to do with, I'm sure he's probably a big supporter of nuclear disarmament, so we can spend the money on something we could actually use, eat, put over our heads, take care of our health with, all instead of destroy and play power politics with. There's an interesting article, by the way, on online. It's at Becky Johnson, One Woman Talking. blogspot.com, kind of a long name, but if you actually, if you Google for the name Sharon Pate, P-A-I-G-H-T, you can follow up on the discussion we had on Sunday. Sharon Pate is a homeless woman, is actually a working homeless woman, works for Goodwill and other agencies for a wage, but not enough to get herself into a house, so she lives in a vehicle, and she is a member of 24-Hour Fitness, a club that enables her to hopefully keep fit and hopefully get a shower, and even she's been known to sleep in her vehicle on the parking lot. And the police went after her and ticketed her, and she went to a trial on that, even although there's no place for her legally to sleep in Santa Cruz and park her vehicle on any public property. So she went on to private property and tried to park it there. There was no complaint from the 24-Hour Fitness, but police went onto the property, took the initiative to harass her, perhaps. Oh, no, a neighbor was nervous seeing someone sleeping in a vehicle. But police should know better in these times that we are in a situation where affordable housing for many people is a vehicle. Now, something I repeat again and again, but it's true every time I say it, so it has to be said again and again. And she got really pretty nasty treatment from Judge Ariadne Simons, who treated her lawyer badly. Ed Fry, we talked to him on Sunday, denied due process by denying him the right to get information from the police department. He was going to go to a court hearing to dismiss the case. She suddenly did the Judge Simon suddenly sprung a trial on him, even though he wasn't ready for a trial. And there was no notice of that day's being a trial. She wouldn't. She interrupted his attempt to have the defendant herself testify and his witnesses testify. She stated without even hearing their testimony that she believed the police officer, without hearing any of the other witnesses, and judges aren't supposed to do this, particularly if they're taking the place of the jury. In infraction cases like the sleeping ban, you don't get a jury. You get a judge pretending that she's the jury. So she's both the person who kind of is supposed to be the rule keeper and the decider of facts as well, which facts are true, guilty or not guilty. And she's supposed to obviously hear both sides before she makes a decision. Not Ariadne Simons, who was previously big-time prosecutor in the office of Bob Lee, the district attorney here in Santa Cruz. And I have to admit to a certain disgust, hostility, skepticism, whimsical, ironic amusement with Ariadne Simons. I saw how she treated my case when I went into court. Essentially, some of you may remember trying to assert the right of a reporter to stand on public property, not blocking anyone, interviewing two homeless people who offended a security guard by saying, "Leave me alone," and "Tell me who you are and who you work for. Give me your superior's name." Instead, he called the police to have me removed because he said I was trespassing on public property. The fact that Simons could find this situation acceptable is amazing. And we're actually appealing this case, and I'm hoping to play the entire audio of the trial. I was given the audio of the trial, but it doesn't play. We've continued to ask the courts to give us something we can actually use. They've continued to insist it works. We've gone to different experts who can't seem to get it working, but who knows? Maybe the courts have some magical system. In any case, but the Judge Simons, who heard the case of Sharon Pate last Friday, and finally just dismissed it without allowing the defense to testify, while upholding the police and also suggesting to her apparently that if she did this again and slept in the property, she would be found guilty. Even though there's no legal shelter for homeless people in Santa Cruz, no emergency walk-in shelter that people can use, and there are 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people in the position, or worse, of Sharon Pate. In other cities, this has resulted in successful lawsuits to end laws that criminalize homeless people in public spaces, like in Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, Richmond, and there are pending lawsuits in Sacramento, Santa Monica, and Santa Barbara. But in Santa Cruz, our attempts to get lawsuits together have not been successful, partially because we're not as organized as we could be, partially because of friction between activists and attorneys, partially because of the difficulties of actually doing it here in terms of finding plaintiffs who are around the area long enough, and partially because of funding. There's a whole number of reasons why we haven't been successful, and there's been some talk of a third round, an attempt to put forward a lawsuit. And also another consideration is the local ACLU is stacked with people like Mike Rutkin, who's on the board of directors, and the vice mayor, who supports the sleeping ban, even though ACLUs in other jurisdictions, in Los Angeles, San Diego, even San Francisco, oppose sleeping bans against the homeless because it's clearly both absurd and cruel. In fact, some would say even a form of torture to declare someone cannot sleep, period, at night, and then also not have any provision for any kind of shelter for them. So saying you can't sleep anywhere, and that's one of the reasons for our downtown campaign, in which we ask merchants to put up a little placard that says, which we distribute, we do not discriminate against the homeless community. We support the right to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. And so we'll see how that's going in Fresno when Michael Rhodes, or Mike Rhodes, calls in about 5 minutes, if he does. And until that time comes, as I said, you can check out the story that Becky Johnson has written. She was actually at the trial, or part of the trial, of Sharon Pate, kind of the kangaroo court, I would say. And it's kind of interesting to say, well, the judge dismissed the case, so she found in favor of Sharon Pate. Well, according to the attorney, Ed Fry, the reason she dismissed the case was that Fry made it quite clear he was going to appeal based on errors in the court procedures, as well as the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of the sleeping ban. And he thought she was trying to avoid that whole issue by simply dismissing the case. And that's always a problem with criminal cases. Either the judge can dismiss it, or the district attorney or city attorney can decline to prosecute, and then whatever wonderful preparation you've done, you're kind of stuck with, well, your defendant gets off, but the next person that comes along can be tried again for the same thing. There's no precedent ruling that the law is unconstitutional. They don't even rule on its constitutionality. To get that, you have to actually go into court and try to get a court order or injunction, and that's what's happened in places, as I've mentioned before, like San Diego and Los Angeles and Laguna Beach and also in Fresno, that they've gotten rulings against. In Fresno, the kind of seizure of homeless property that Chief Ranger Wallace and his kleptomaniac patrols in the Poganip do when they go around destroying tents and homeless property and not storing it as they're supposed to do under state law. In order to stop this kind of practice in Fresno, you didn't go after, you know, people who just got tickets for having their property in a place where it shouldn't be for camping, but they went after a broad court order that showed many people were being damaged by these actions by the police departments of Fresno, and that's what we need to do here as well. Call-in number here for those of you who have any thoughts on these issues or reflections of any sort, 427-3772, 427-FRSC is the number here. And I think what I'm going to do actually before I get this expected call from Mike is check out if I can get the my computer to operate properly. Let's see what we got here. Here's an article that I picked up from, I mentioned the website antiwar.org. Okay, again, I'm having a little problem here with a somewhat cranky computer. I have to make sure it... here's an article called War? What War? Netroots Nation Comes Down with Amnesia by Justin Raimondo. And this was written about a week ago on August 21st. The Netroots Nation conference held last weekend in Pittsburgh attracted some attention, at least in the circles I move in, on account of Bill Clinton putting another uppity gay in his place. Challenged by an audience member over the gays in the military issue, Clinton went off on the guy by demanding to know what progressives, when progressives were going to start backing up their ideology with action. "You didn't back us up," he whined to general approval. And indeed, the big question at this year's annual progressive powwow was, as Slate puts it, how do we hold Obama to his campaign promises? There was plenty of concern about Obama's dedication to closing Guantanamo, abolishing indefinite detention, shoring up gay rights, and implementing immigration reform, not to mention ending the wars and the occupation. Of course, between health care and climate change and fixing the economy, there are plenty of commitments the administration hasn't backed away from. So the fundamental disagreement among attendees was, actually this is what the people at Netroots were saying, not what the author of the article is saying. Should we of the Netroots be fundamentally supportive of Obama, or should we oppose him from the left? And you can probably guess what they decided, but I'll leave you hanging because we'll have to go now to our phone and see who's calling in. Well, it looks like nobody's calling in at the moment. Try again, caller, 427-3772 or 469-3119. Try the second number first if you can, if we're talking about a guest caller from Fresno. And sorry for the delay on this article. The article, actually, I'm going to kind of move beyond it, but the main point that is being made here is the difference between how George W. Bush got treated, as you heard me discussing with the caller who's backing Proposition 1, the anti-nuclear disarmament, the pro-disarmament initiatives that he's pushing for across the country, and the difference between how George W. Bush got really a lot of harsh treatment and Obama is getting very, very soft treatment, and he's essentially ramping things up overseas. But I guess we can only say that so many times without going hoarse. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, it's Mike Rhodes in Fresno.
Hey, Mike, I kind of thought it might be you. In fact, I've been, have you been listening to me blathering on about you?
No, I wasn't able to do that. I was haranguing the local ACLU chairperson, trying to get him involved with an incident that happened here. My ears were burning.
Were you successful in getting your ACLU guy involved? And what was the incident you were trying to get him involved in?
Well, a couple things. One is there's a move by the city of Fresno to evict homeless people that'll take place tomorrow morning. And I did Bill Simon. He's the chairperson of the local ACLU chapter. He and another member are going to go down there with cameras tomorrow morning and monitor the situation and see what happens. I was talking to him about some of the logistics on all that. So yeah, they are helping on some things.
Now, is that actually unusual for the local ACLU to do?
No, they've done that before.
Oh, good.
In fact, one incident led to a letter from Homeland Security warning them about going out to the city of Fresno yard. They were investigating where the city took homeless people's property, and while they were out there, they became noticed by Homeland Security because they were sort of wandering around looking at where the material might be. And so they got a letter, actually. Phil got a letter from Homeland Security warning him that if he was to go out there again, he should really give them a call first so that they didn't become alarmed.
So, in other words, do you think there might be some new unlawful combatants over in Bagram soon?
Well, funniest thing, you know, that they sent us that letter, and then we had Bill Simon and Phil and I had a meeting with the police to talk to them about their video surveillance project here, which is a whole other big issue. But,
which I want to hear about as well. Go ahead.
While we were in the parking lot, I was talking to Bill after the meeting. The head of the Homeland Security Liaison Department with the Fresno PD comes out as I'm talking to Bill, and he starts talking to Bill thinking he's Phil, which, you know, they don't look alike to me, but you would think that Homeland Security and all their, you know, cameras and everything, they would at least be able to know, you know, Phil Connolly from Bill Simon. But he talked to Bill for almost 5 minutes thinking he was Phil, who is the guy who they...
Well, obviously they need more sophisticated facial recognition equipment.
I think they might, maybe they're going to put like one of those RFID chips in under our arms, so they all have to do is scan us, and then they have our whole history.
Yeah, or maybe just sort of a retinal scan, or maybe an anal scan, an anal probe, perhaps.
Only you would think of that.
Yes.
I was just sort of surprised that the guy even came out. I mean, he came out of nowhere and came into the parking lot and started talking to us about this. We weren't there to see him or anything, but he comes over and he's like yakking at us, but he's thinking that we're somebody completely different.
Yeah, I hope you videoed this and are putting it online.
Oh, I wish. No, I don't have my camera going all the time. Let me tell you about the other incident that I was telling Bill about and trying to interest them in becoming involved in it. This is an incident that happened early this morning, like 5 o'clock this morning. Randy Johnson, who was one of the named plaintiffs lawsuit against the city of Fresno.
The Kincaid lawsuit?
Yes, the Kincaid lawsuit, where we won $2.3 million because they were bulldozing homeless encampments, and we got them to back off. And we, you know, won a significant settlement in that case. Anyway, Randy was one of the named plaintiffs in that case, but he's still homeless. He's still living on the street. He and his wife were sleeping on F Street, on the sidewalk, on F Street. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, police car pulls up and puts tickets on. Randy has two cars. That's what he got in the settlement, what he chose to buy. So they ticketed two of his cars that were sitting on the street.
For what?
That's just it. They have painted a red line on the curb on one whole side of the street, which is totally bogus because there's no reason for it. But they've done that. But it's sort of spotty. They didn't do a good job. So there's some parts that are really questionable whether it's a red zone or not. Anyway, he was parked there, but he says that he had authorization to do that at night from a police officer that he talked to during the day.
So Randy said he had the authorization to park there.
That's right.
In the red zone. It's interesting. We had another activist ourselves, now dead, the guy called Richard Quigley, who was challenging deputies out of the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center who had a sheriff's substation where they painted a special area red. He ignored it and said there's no authorization in the law for them to paint areas red without some kind of public hearing or legislative
uh-huh.
justification. And, you know, they hassled him. He hassled them. But the point is, some people will stand up to this, but most of us won't. And so it's interesting that your friend Randy did. And what happened?
Okay. So he gets up. He sees them putting tickets on his car. And mind you, too, that there's other cars on the street parked there. There's people living in RVs. There's vans there that have been there for some time. None of them got tickets. Randy's got tickets.
You know, all the rest of the cars are in the red zone, too.
Yeah, they're in the same place as his was. But they didn't get ticketed. So Randy gets up, and he gets the tickets. He says a few words to the officer, like, fuck you know, you stop harassing me. He gets the tickets, wads them up, throws them on the ground. The officer gets out of his car, and Randy, like, from previous experience with the police, he ran. And the officer told him to halt or he was going to be shot. And Randy stopped. And just as he stopped, he got tasered. So he's knocked to the ground, jumping around like a fish brought on deck, and just banged himself all up. I was just talking to Randy. I went out there to see him about 2 hours ago.
He's in the jail or in the hospital?
No. He's all banged up. Okay, so then they bring the ambulance out, and they take him to the hospital, and they tell him, the officers tell him that he, Randy, is going to be charged with assaulting an officer.
He assaulted the taser from 15 feet away with his belly?
Oh, no, it was the ticket that he threw on the ground that was allegedly thrown menacingly at the officer, what he said. But then Randy was never booked. He was never taken to the county jail. He was released from the hospital. So I don't think that they're going to press charges on him on the assault charges. But he's understandably pissed about being harassed. A couple of months ago, maybe 2 months ago, he had his wrist broken by an officer in that same area when he was trying to get his wife's attention. She was at one of the service centers at near the Pavarello house, and he was yelling her name. The police came, said he was being disruptive, and then he was put in handcuffs, and when he was put in handcuffs, they broke his wrist. So that's what I was trying to get the ACLU to look at, and in part because Randy believes that this is retaliation by the police specifically directed at him because he was one of the named plaintiffs. And, he believes that's true. I don't know if it is or not, but I think that since the ACLU was involved in the lawsuit, that they should probably talk to him. And, if there's retaliation that's taking place, they should be concerned about that.
Have there been other reports of retaliation against named plaintiffs?
There's been several incidences that have happened right after the settlement was announced. One of the named plaintiffs was attacked. I don't really know who did that. I think it was another person on the street. They were demanding money from her. She got jumped. She didn't have any money from the settlement because it was like the day that all this stuff happened. It was in the news. And so that happened.
Have there been that was some years ago, right? I mean, settlement was in 2007 or 2008.
It was like a year and a half ago, maybe.
So I'm talking about in the last year. Is it your? I'm not saying it isn't possible that Randy isn't getting retaliated against. Certainly, whether he's being retaliated against or not, sounds pretty selective. If it's only him that's getting ticketed.
Al Williams, too, another homeless man.
No, well, what I'm saying is it's selective in this particular case this morning. If all these other vehicles are sitting there on the street.
Oh, right, right.
And he gets the citation, it's obvious he's being, for some reason, singled out.
Well, yeah, I would say so.
Have time to ticket everybody else. Maybe everybody else has a special permit from the homeless czar, whoever he may be in Fresno. But Randy is getting ticketed for that. So Bill Simon of the ACLU there actually is going to come down tomorrow with a camera. And are you expecting a reprise of this morning's events, another raid by the police? Or
I don't know. What I think is going to happen tomorrow is that the city is going to move in and dismantle an encampment that has been established on roughly on Golden State Boulevard, just to the west of G Street.
Now, Fresno is an area that's had several ongoing homeless-run encampments, some of them given very minor support by the city, like porta-potties and security guards guarding the porta potties.
$13,000 a month.
Also barbed wire and fenced areas in which one of the encampments at least has been denuded of people. And I guess there is some. You mentioned that some of the people in that encampment did get limited housing, and some didn't. I guess some of the people that were in that encampment went to the encampment that you're now talking about, that is now about to be attacked by the police and dispersed.
Right. Yeah. So they've been chased out of the H Street encampment, and now they're over on Golden State, and they're about to be evicted from there too. And I was talking to some of the people that live there just a little while ago, and they were saying they didn't want to go, that the place that they were being told to move to, which is an encampment called The Hill, was too loud, that they were uncomfortable there, but they have really no place else to go. And so the city seems to be pushing people closer and closer to the rescue mission and the Poverello House, which are two big social service agencies.
Poverty pimp groups, you mean?
Yeah, that's probably a better description of them. Areas there have really gotten a lot bigger. And where Randy lives there on F Street, there's dozens and dozens of new tents and people now wrapping around the corner, and it's just sort of a substitute for the village or the community that had developed over on H Street.
So they're going to try to eliminate this tomorrow morning? That they made an announcement, they're going to go after it then?
Yeah. They've posted signs. They've gone out and talked to them. Everybody knows it's coming. And so what I can tell is that everybody was, you know, resigned to it. It was, they don't want to move, but it's like they don't feel that they really have a choice. What could they do to resist it?
Well, it's kind of strange, Mike. If you have your city is one of the few cities where the homeless have won a large legal victory, where the mayor, a new mayor supposedly is backing, I don't know. I mean, they didn't spend the money last year that they had for homeless funding, but they got a homeless czar who's spending some money this year. You know, you have a second lawsuit going against, the rescue mission and their harassment activities. So there is some support from the legal community. Is it there's just not much grassroots activism? Are people just demoralized? Is it too hot in Fresno, both metaphorically and literally, in the height of summer? I mean, what's going on down there?
Well, I think that there's no clear route to resistance at that encampment. If they were to stay, it's unclear what the city of Fresno would do.
But you got video cameras, you got ACLU guys who are willing to make the same kind of documentation you made when you won the Kincaid lawsuit, right?
Yeah, but the people there don't seem like they're willing to entrench themselves. One of the things it's all fine and good for me to say that they should stay there and fight.
Oh, I understand.
They're the ones that would end up in jail.
For sure. And I'm just saying, though, that why do you think people's attitudes have changed over the last 3 years? Are they just beaten down? Is it a different group of people?
There's a combination of things. One is that there's certainly a carrot and stick approach to this. And that's one of the things I was talking to Bill Simon about earlier, the ACLU chairperson here, is that the people there are being told that if they, you know, go along with this program and they move, that they're in line to get vouchers. So the city of Fresno is telling them that, you know, if they...
Vouchers for what?
Housing. For apartments.
And do you believe this is true?
Well, there's some evidence to suggest that it's true. About 150 people did get vouchers for some kind of housing. Not good, decent housing, but they are now off the street. They're no longer homeless. These were people that were at the H Street encampment, and I can tell you all kinds of criticisms I have of the process and how they sort of processed them and selected who was going to be worthy of receiving housing, which, you know, and there's probably some validity to taking people who need it.
Now, are these people who... who actually won the lawsuit and got housing that way? Or these are people who are getting money through this 10-year program of we're ending homelessness by giving a lot of money to poverty pimps and giving some money to people for housing, right?
Well,
I'm putting it in a rather stark way from my perspective.
Yeah, well, Greg would argue, he's the homelessness czar, he would argue that this is some modified version of Housing First, which attempts to give homeless people housing irregardless of their situation. It's just, you know, if you're homeless, you're better off in permanent housing where you're not insecure, you're not on the street, you have a place to shower.
Right, so the 150 people who already have this do have permanent housing, period, or only for a month or for a year? What do they got?
Oh, well, that we don't know yet. I mean, he ain't going to say, because, you know, if he were to say, oh, it's only for 2 months, then, you know, then we would, you know, let people know that. But what he's saying is that we don't know how much money we're going to have in the future. And they're expecting several million dollars in stimulus money, et cetera. And there is reason to believe that there's $2 or $3 million that are going to be here in October to start housing more people, and it could extend the people's leases where they are. So we really don't know how long they're going to be there. I don't know if Greg knows how long they're going to be there.
Well, wait a minute, though. I mean, how much, what percentage, you told me that last year, not a penny of the $1 million-plus that was given to the mayor on homeless stuff was spent on any homeless programs.
Yeah.
So what percentage of the money this year has actually been spent?
Well, they just started a new fiscal year, Robert. So, this money that they're talking about is sort of outside of the city budget. It's money that's coming from the federal government. So it's totally new money. It's not money that is coming out of the general fund, but is a part of this federal stimulus package.
Is the city spending any of the money? Is the city still getting money itself each year that it's refusing to spend on homeless housing and such?
Well, there's all kinds of,
I'm looking for the short answer here. I'm trying to compare it with last year so I can see if there's any change, if it's the same, if it's better.
The budget this year was really hard to see. It was very cloudy. They wouldn't categorize things in the same way they did last year, and so it's hard for me to understand, you know, to compare apples to apples.
You're talking about the city's budget, not this homelessness czar federal budget guy, right?
Right. Yeah, I'm talking about the city of Fresno money. I suspect, my belief is, Robert, that the city of Fresno spent way less of the budgeted money for homelessness last year. They probably spent $1 million of it where they had put like $5 or $6 million into the budget. They probably diverted that other money for other purposes, and that it didn't go to homelessness. I think that, you know, if you were to look at that.
And we're talking fiscal year, like July to June of this year. That's what you mean by last year?
Yeah, exactly. And then this year, I just haven't really been able to figure out the direct comparison between the categories they had last year to this year. But what Greg is talking about more is this extra money that's coming in from the federal government that he's going to put all into this Housing First program. The problem with the rest of the money that's in the city budget that's probably being used is it's going to, as you term them, poverty pimps. And I think that a good portion of the money is going to, like the Poverello house that gets several $100,000 a year to maintain and run about 100 tool sheds, which homeless people are forced to live in. So, you know, they will categorize that as being money spent on the homeless. You know, they'll say we're spending $350,000 for housing on the homeless, but, you know, the reality is that you're putting two homeless people in each tool shed, and, you know, it gets to be 105, 110 degrees here at night, or during the day, and then at night it might, you know, these things, they're out in the open sun.
Do you have any medical authorities who've come down and given their analysis as to the healthful nature of the Poverello House tool sheds that are being so funded as homeless housing?
Well, I just got an email from somebody who is involved with lawsuits against agencies and businesses that don't comply with fair housing. And they were saying that, you know, this is a case that, you know, it's perfect in a lot of ways because they're got these tool sheds that are non-compliant on a gazillion of ways. You know, they don't have running water, they don't have air conditioning, they don't have toilets, they're not wheelchair accessible. They're all these kinds of problems with them. And what she was saying is that, you know, they're trying to pursue this, and they're just getting all kinds of flack from different government agencies. And she was asking, you know, kind of asking me out loud, well, why do I think that is? Well, I think that the city of Fresno has bought into this as a solution for homelessness, and they're closely allied with the Poverello House, which is the largest social service agency in Fresno, for homelessness in Fresno. And they're not nearly as bad as the Rescue Mission, which is right down the street. As you mentioned, there was a lawsuit against them, which has been settled now, that said that they would send their crews out, which they call disciples, to destroy homeless people's property, the purpose of which was to drive the homeless into the Rescue Mission so that they could make them a part of their program. They can get more funding by having more people in their program. It was just a vicious circle.
Let me ask you about the encampments again to let people know, because Santa Cruz, that's always been a proposal that we've had here. We go back to Camp Paradise 2001, or go back to the Coral Street Open Air Shelter of 1995, or the Coalition for a Safe Place to Sleep back in 1990. Tent cities in Santa Cruz have always been at least an idea. Obviously, it's cheaper than building housing. It's more immediate. It can be more homeless run. It's a way of, you know, at least allowing for people to use access to bathrooms and showers and have their own property in an area where they can watch over each other's stuff. It's a sort of an emergency shelter idea. You see the Red Cross use it when there's a fire, like there was here. Actually, they were putting people up in hotels, but after the earthquake, it was used extensively there, where they put up these makeshift tents and camps. So tent cities are important, and Fresno is probably one of the cities in California, although I guess Los Angeles' Skid Row is maybe in many respects a massive tent city, though I haven't seen many pictures of it recently. Mm-hmm. And they have some new rules about you have to be 10 feet away from a building at night in order to avoid the city's sleeping ban law. But if you are, then you're allowed to sleep at night on the streets anywhere in Los Angeles, not just in Skid Row, under the Jones settlement. But Fresno is famous for having tent cities that survive, unlike Sacramento, where the mayor rolls into town and gives all these jolly words about, hey, we're going to have a tent city project next March, and we'll house 60 people. In the meantime, fuck off. He doesn't say it that way, of course. He says, you know, we're studying that. We've got a commission together. I spent the night with homeless people. How exciting. I mean, actually, I'm kind of impressed that the mayor of Sacramento did that, and I played that on the air a week or two ago. But Fresno actually has ongoing homeless encampments that it seems like the city is afraid to move on because of your successful lawsuit. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, they move very cautiously. They're constrained where they had previously just been taking and destroying homeless people's property. Now they're very careful to only clean up, or in the case of what's going to happen tomorrow morning in one particular encampment, when they dismantle an encampment, if there's anybody that's still there or there's property that's still there, they store it for 90 days. You know, it's a small victory, but it has, you know, did get their attention, and they are cautious about moving on homeless encampments, and yes, I think that's why they allowed the H Street encampment to grow and develop, and we have the Hill, and now there's people living on Santa Clara Street and F Street and Ventura Street, which are all, Ventura is a pretty big street in Fresno.
So how many encampments have we got now, and what are the approximate size of each?
Well, let's see. You'd be talking about the one in front of the Pavarello house where Randy Johnson was assaulted this morning. And that, there's probably 150, maybe 200 people living there. And it's sort of spread out around a couple of blocks. So
any porta-potties or facilities for people to use?
It's right next to the Pavarello house. So people can just walk in there anytime during the day and use the toilets there.
And at night you just go piss on the tires. Is that the plan?
Piss on the wall of the Pavarello house,
there
I guess.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
And then there's another one, another encampment down the street from there, by the rescue mission. It's called The Hill. And there's, boy, now, there wasn't that many people there when I went by there today, maybe 50 to 60. But if the people move over from that Golden, State encampment, then there'll be another 20 or 30, 40 people there. Maybe there'd be 100 people there. Then there's another interesting one that I don't think I've mentioned before, Robert, over on Santa Fe, which is still in the downtown area, Santa Fe and Ventura Street. And it is, there's probably, it looks like there's a good hundred people there, too.
100 people, you say?
Yeah. And the unique thing about that is that, as near as I can tell, these are all people who are, sexual offenders that are out on parole or probation. I guess they call them 290s is what I understand. And what I've heard, I went out and talked to these people. What they tell me is that the parole agents take them there and drop them off there and tell them that that's where they're supposed to stay and for them not to move. That is their home. That's where they live. And you've got all these tents under the overpass there. Now it's extending way beyond there, where there's more and more people living there. I talked to Greg Barfield the other day about this. I said, Greg, you know, do you know about this, and what do you think about it? And he's like, yeah, it seems like it's a problem to me that we've got all these people in one place. And not only that, you've got parole dropping them off there and telling them to stay.
Have there been any, I mean, it sounds like this could be a recipe for some kind of vigilante, you know, violence against this encampment if there's, let's say, a report of somebody, some sexual assault somewhere, and they blame the people in this encampment, and they just come and burn everybody out or beat them up. I mean, maybe that kind of thing doesn't happen in Fresno. I don't know.
No, it does. One of the things Randy Johnson was telling me about, and he doesn't live there. He lives over on F Street, but he said the reason that he parks his car right next to where he sleeps is that it's protection, because people drive by and throw bricks and eggs and whatnot at homeless people, and so with the car being there, it provides some protection, and that's why he said he parks his car there. And you know, so when he got a ticket, he was very upset about it. But to go back to the 290s over on Santa Fe, that could be a problem. I mean, the other problem I have with that, Robert, is that I think, from what I've read, and I'm not real well versed in this, but my understanding is that one of the predictors of ongoing offense by sexual offenders is that they're homeless and they don't have a place to live. So if you're forcing people to be homeless who are just out of jail and putting them in a homeless encampment, it seems like, if those statistics are true, that you're increasing the odds that they may reoffend. And that's not good for them. It's not good for the community. There's got to be a better way of dealing with that situation.
We're talking with Michael Rhodes, or Mike Rhodes, I should say, from Fresno. You find a lot of this stuff if you go to Street Spirit newspaper, although it doesn't have a website. but you can also buy Street Spirit if you're up in the Bay Area, and even if you're in Santa Cruz, if you call the Huff line at 423-HUFF. We may be able to, Mike, get some incoming calls if anybody wants to ask or comment on anything you're telling us. Call-in number here is 427-3772, so feel free to, any of you listeners out there, to call in and ask Mike any questions. Mike, with his little Kodak there, has been, and I guess your daughter also has been instrumental with her video camera in helping to document the kinds of property destruction by authorities that resulted in a successful federal lawsuit 3 years ago, the Kincaid case. You're also concerned about other issues in I keep saying thinking of Santa Cruz because actually issues are similar, but
right.
We have a drug war here in Santa Cruz. We say a war on people, masquerading as a war on drugs, where we have they've shut down all the medical marijuana applications for dispensaries. Moratorium has been put in place on all grow houses and new dispensaries. What's going on with the drug war over in Fresno?
Well, the drug czar, the national drug czar, Kurlikowski, was in Fresno about a month ago, and he attended a press conference where I was at. The sheriff of Fresno, Sheriff Margaret Mims, called a press conference, and they were announcing this campaign to eradicate marijuana that was being grown in the Sierra Nevada. The mountains just to the east of us here, and they were announced. It was really interesting because they were talking about the scope of the project and that they had, at that point, destroyed $1.6 billion, billion with a B, dollars worth of marijuana, 400,000 plants in the Sierra, in Fresno County, which is an astounding number because it makes Fresno County the second largest producer of marijuana in the state. And I know there's a lot of marijuana grown in the state of California. I just had no idea that it was that big in Fresno. What they did was they tried to say that the marijuana that's being grown here is all controlled by the Mexican mafia. And they backed that up by showing photos of 90 Mexican nationals that had been arrested. It was 89 out of 90 were Mexicans. One person, incidentally, that was not a Mexican that was arrested in this. It's called Save Our Sierras, SOS, a clever little name for their campaign. Was up near Dunlap. I went up there and talked to some of the people engaged in growing and the production of marijuana in the Sierras. And they said, the person I talked to was like, you know, Mexican drug cartels, they're, you know, he's never seen it up there. What happened to this other person that got arrested is that all the helicopters, and there were a lot of them up in the Sierras at that time, would hover over places where they were seeing that there was marijuana being grown. And one of the high school students saw them hovering in this one area up there. And so he, you know, when they were gone, he went down there and gathered it all up and took it home and was about to dry it. And the police came knocking at his door. So that's how he got busted. He got busted because he, well, was stupid, I guess, to go down where they were monitoring these patches of marijuana and harvested it. But he was the only person that they arrested that wasn't a Mexican national. And so they're trying to link it to the drug cartels in Mexico and say, oh, well, it's all dangerous. It's all the Mexican drug cartels that are doing this, and they're destroying the forests by putting in all these chemicals and herbicides and fertilizers, watering systems. And I have no doubt that some of that happens and that there is damage that takes place there.
But playing devil's advocate here, we know that these Mexicans are naturally knife-wielding marijuana growers from way back, just like we know blacks dance very well and Chinese are very slanty-eyed. So
that's just it. I see if you go with those caricatures of who's doing this and how dangerous they are, then, you know, you're going to get some public support for this eradication of marijuana that's being grown up in the Sierras. And that's what they were aiming at. They were
Are progressives actually able to counter any of this stuff? I mean, you know, in the Bay Area, you have Amiano, Assemblyman Amiano's bill to legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana. Is there any support for that in Fresno? I mean, you think that that would be a nice money-making venture for political hacks who want more money for their general funds, right?
Well, so here's what's happening in Fresno is that they have, the city of Fresno, city council, has passed an ordinance regarding medical marijuana dispensaries. And basically what it says is that there can be medical marijuana dispensaries in Fresno if they are compliant with both state and federal law.
Oh,
of course,
come on.
Their interpretation of that is that it's marijuana is against federal law.
You know, that's like what we have in Santa Cruz, which states that Santa Cruz is going to be opening an office of compassionate use for marijuana to provide marijuana to poor people when it's federally legal to do so. Although,
yeah,
you know, we have to say that at least Santa Cruz, mainly because the Santa Cruz electorate passed overwhelmingly in 1993 Measure A, which said, you know, in the county of Santa Cruz, medical marijuana is just fine. We opened up medical marijuana dispensaries 2 years, 3 years before Proposition 215 passed in 1996. And it's only after the city council has been cracking down starting in 2000 and increasing regulation this year in 2009. Well, they've made it hard to open medical marijuana dispensaries and so forth. You know, but the fact is, it's if you waited for the feds, you'd be waiting, you know, forever, obviously. So are you saying there are no medical marijuana dispensaries in Fresno?
No, there are. There's, there's one Medmar that's in the Tower District.
Well, is this Medmar compliant with the Fresno law? Because obviously it's, you know, the feds have not okayed this in spite of some ambivalent signals given out earlier this year. Feds continue to bust marijuana dispensaries in Los Angeles and San Francisco and to prosecute those they busted before.
Okay, so the answer is that what the city of Fresno has done is they have filed a lawsuit against Medmar. And Medmar is one of, and I'm not absolutely certain of this, but the attorney for Medmar, who I've talked to, said that there are 14 medical marijuana dispensaries in the Fresno area. And some of those might be collectives or cooperatives. I'm not exactly sure how they're defining medical marijuana dispensaries in that list of 14. But Medmar is the only one that they've gone after. Now, the interesting thing about that I see is that they have filed a lawsuit against Medmar. You know, they didn't send the DEA in there and arrest people and take their product. They filed a lawsuit asking, saying that they were a hazard to the community and, you know, corrupting the morals of the youth or whatever, and that they were asking for a preliminary injunction, a temporary restraining order from the courts. Now, if you have somebody selling heroin on the street corner, do you go get a court order or you file a lawsuit against them? Not usually.
Well, also marijuana is against, you know, possession of marijuana, even if it's medical marijuana, is against state law. It is true that Proposition 215 allows you to use medical marijuana if you have a doctor's recommendation as an affirmative defense, but that doesn't stop police from seizing your marijuana if they want to. That's been the case. I mean, there have been agreements. The Highway Patrol, I think, has agreed not to do that. And, and certain other police agencies have agreed not to do it, but there's no statewide ruling that you can't seize somebody's medicine until such time as they go to court, and then they say, it's my medicine, it's an affirmative defense, here's my recommendation. In fact, I got a report yesterday, I haven't played it on the air, from Lawrence, who I played on the air earlier. You probably didn't hear him. Lawrence McDougal, I think his name is, that four police officers, and he had their names and badge numbers, came up to him on the tracks yesterday, took his marijuana recommendation, gave him no charge, no ticket, and just walked off with it. And
well,
so,
and they're probably using it tonight.
I have no idea if they're using it or if it was simply, you know, a coercive tool, or if perhaps Lawrence is exaggerating or not telling us the truth. That story, however, does concern me because I've heard some stories similar to that, although I've also heard stories of police officers respecting medical marijuana cards or recommendations in Santa Cruz. But it is really difficult. It should be legal to smoke marijuana, particularly if it's medical marijuana, wherever you need to smoke it, provided you aren't, you know, blowing smoke in someone else's face. But there's extremely restrictive state laws. I think it's 1,000 feet from a public school, a public youth facility, a public park, and which essentially leaves out most urban areas that are not inside a residence. So it's kind of hard. We're talking with Mike Rhodes of Fresno, California, and I kind of cut into your time on the homeless discussion there. For those who want to really follow your articles, Mike, which are really articulate, they're well photographed, even some video and audio are involved, you can go to indiebay.org/Central Valley, and or just, I guess you can Google for Mike Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S. Although there may be many Mike Rhodes, for all I know.
There are a few, but if you go to indiebay.org and then go to the Central Valley page, you'll see some of the articles I wrote there.
Just very quickly, because we're running out of time here, and I have a man who's lost his van in the studio. The infamous Crow here has come limping in with one wing broken, hauling his sleeping bag with him. Hi, Crow.
They towed my school bus. I have a 35-foot purple school bus that they towed on Saturday without getting any warning or 72-hour notice at that time.
So it's obviously time for you to bring Bill Simon and all his ACLU buddies over to Santa Cruz.
We'll be right over.
Yeah, I've heard that before. What about this poor clown that the cops assaulted and then charged with psychiatric eccentricity and dumped in a state prison or hospital somewhere? Who was that guy?
Oh, jeez.
What's happened? Glenn what?
Beatty.
Glenn Beatty. What's happened with him?
I talked to Glenn on Monday. He's in the Fresno County Jail where he's been since February. Glenn was...
Has he been convicted of anything?
No.
So he's just been held for month after month with no conviction?
Not even charged.
Oh, that's right, because he's a psychiatric... what is he accused of being psychiatrically what?
Incompetent to assist in his defense.
Yeah, but what if he's not defending against anything, why does he have to be competent to assist in his defense?
Well...
It's a mystery, isn't it? Yeah.
There's some context to this. Glenn was beaten by the police on video, which was shown around the world in early February, and then he was put in the Fresno County Jail, and he had some outstanding an outstanding warrant on him or something, a parole violation or probation violation, which they held him on, and the police tried to get him charged with assaulting the police officers in that incident that was videotaped, but the district attorney refused to press charges.
But he wouldn't press charges against the police officers for assaulting Glenn Beatty either, right?
I think that's going to be a civil lawsuit that'll emerge at some point. But the problem is that Glenn has been in the Fresno County Jail just being held while they do tests on him, while they consider what they're going to do with him. A month or two ago, they decided that they were going to send him to Atascadero because he was ruled to be mentally incompetent.
Atascadero is a pretty nasty state hospital, right?
State mental facility, mental health facility. I don't really know that much about it, but with budget cutbacks and the lack of space that they have, there's no space available, and he's just like on a waiting list to go there. And in the meantime, they keep him in this cell with like 10 other people, and he never gets out. The only time he said he gets out is when I come and visit him. Nobody else is going to visit him.
What about Bill Simon, your ACLU buddy?
Well, he's not on the visitors list, but
oh,
he
I see.
Hey,
that explains it, I guess.
get over there that often, and it's just a horrible situation where this guy is in this cell 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and at some point they're going to take him to this gulag where he's going to be locked away and forgotten about for maybe the rest of his life.
Well, I don't quite understand. We're supposed to, I know this happens to enemy combatants like 12-year-olds who are sold to the U.S. forces in Afghanistan and accused of being enemy non-combatants, then held and tortured for about 6 or 7 years, and then finally quietly released and flown back to Afghanistan like this guy was last week. So we know, but that's the war on terror. You know, we got to hold those 12-year-old terrorists. But here you have a situation where the police are the terrorists, and this guy seems to be the victim. I mean, don't you have, isn't there an ACLU attorney who's willing to walk into court and demand a writ of habeas corpus for this guy? I'm talking federal court, man. Walk into a fucking federal court and do it. I mean, that seems to me the way to go. If you have anybody who knows, you know, the U.S. Constitution, like, they should.
It seems like a no-brainer to me, and I'm just, I keep, you know.
What does Bill Simon have to say about this whole issue?
Well, you know, part of the thing is that the local chapter, the ACLU, is pretty much reliant upon the resources, the legal resources, of the Northern California chapter in San Francisco. And so what they've got to do is to get somebody there interested in these cases. And then, you know, they've got to come from there to become involved in the legal issues. And it's a long way to come. I'm not making excuses for them, but I am saying that that's the reality, is that...
Why don't you drag old Bill over to the jail on your next visit to Glenn? Get him on the, you know, first of all, get him on the list. Take a couple pictures of Glenn. Audio record his interview. And, well, I've got all kinds of advice for you, Mike. I know you're doing, tomorrow morning you're going to be down there defending homeless people. This morning you were doing this. Obviously, we need 10 people like you down there. You know, that's the problem.
We also need some legal people who can jump on these things when they come up, especially this Glenn Beatty case. It's just so ripe for somebody to jump on to bring some justice to it.
Glenn Beatty, B-E-A-T-Y.
That's right.
So for those who want to check out Glenn Beatty and the video beating of Beatty, followed by his incarceration on zero charges from February to August, check, you know, go online, Glenn Beatty, B as in boy, E-A-T as in Thomas, Y. Mike, I'm running up against the clock here. Is there stuff we haven't talked about? I'm sure there is that we should get into. Food Not Bombs serving food down there. You have any free radio stations we should know about that have opened up? You found all.
I talked to my contact at the, who has the pirate radio station, and he says that they're not doing a pirate radio project in downtown. So I don't know where that rumor came from, but apparently we don't have a pirate radio station here in Fresno.
It may be that pirate radio has had its day and come and gone with the internet around, although. I guess with the FTC trying to regulate the internet, we may have to go back to pirate radio.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, let me leave you with one other story, because stories are always good. And you know, Al Williams was also ticketed. And Al Williams is a homeless man that was part of a lawsuit against the city of Fresno. He's one of the named plaintiffs. And he was talking to his friend the other day, Terry, down by Roding Park, and standing outside of a convenience store, the police came up and told him to leave, that he was trespassing. And, you know, they live in the area. They just bought something in there, and they stepped out, and they were talking. So they moved over by the... bus stop, and they continued their conversation. They were just about to say goodbye, and the police came again and cited them for trespassing. Now, they're standing, like, next to a public sidewalk, next to a bus stop, not bothering anybody, but they got a ticket.
This sounds hauntingly familiar here, like what happened to this guy I know who I see every day I look in a mirror.
Anyway, so...
Go ahead.
They... you know, showed me the tickets. I took pictures of them, and there were some real inconsistencies with the tickets. One of them wasn't signed. Terry didn't sign his, and there's two different names of the officers on there, but they were written by the same person. And so the next week, they come out, start, and they're looking for Terry because they want him to sign his ticket. Now, they're spending all this time tracking him down. They went to his place where he lives. They were asking his friends where he was. They were seriously looking for this guy. And now what they're doing is they're following him around, taking pictures of him wherever he goes. The police are following Terry around, taking pictures. So I got a camera for Terry to take a picture of them while they're taking a picture of him.
Dueling cameras, man.
They're little disposable one-use cameras. They're very handy to have.
I use them regularly. I feel a little guilty because I think they're not terribly environmentally sound. It's better to have one you can, you know, upload to a computer quickly, and I'm still technologically in the dark ages. But
yeah, no, you should do that. It's not hard to do. But when you're handing out, you know, cameras to different people, you know, giving them a $5 camera is a lot easier than giving them a more expensive one.
For sure, for sure. So are you going to write a story about maybe updating us on Glenn Beatty, updating us on Terry, updating us on medical marijuana capers in Fresno?
I'm always writing. You can read my posts on indiebay.org. Go to the Central Valley page, and I'll be there. By the way, I'm pressing Bob Aronson, who's now the interim independent police auditor in Fresno.
Gag me, man.
To follow up on the Glenn Beatty situation.
How
nice,
yeah.
My feeling is that if you can't do something about that, then you might as well just go back to Santa Cruz.
Yeah, well, please get rid of him. He's been in Santa Cruz since 2003, and he hasn't done shit here, with the exception of the one incident in 2006 when he told the city manager, no, it's not okay for the deputy police chief to investigate himself. That doesn't work too well. So we thank Bob for that wonderful ruling. Thank you, Bob. And I know that we talked about this. I remember you raised the issue that Bob Aronson, who is our police auditor, who only reports secretly to the city council, and we get no written reports from him at all, he has been considered and I guess appointed the Fresno auditor as some sort of sop to the concern about, you know, police accountability, which has nothing to do. His appointment has nothing to do with police accountability, as far as I'm concerned.
He's the interim.
Yeah, interim.
And I don't know if they're going to hire him as the official.
Well, it's not that he's a bad guy, and it's not. It's just the whole idea of the position that has no power is a meaningless position, and the position that has no constituency to force it to act has no meaning. So.
If he can't get Glenn Beatty out of the Fresno County Jail when he's been charged with nothing, then I don't know why we have a police auditor at all.
I think he'll be the first person to tell you he can't do anything about that case. He can simply oversee police behavior because the jail, he will say, has a court matter having to do with court decisions and yada, yada, yada. In other words, I don't think he'll regard that as within his jurisdiction, and he will say so in fine legal scholarly language.
So, okay, well, I'll wait for it.
All right. Well, I could be wrong, and I give Bob my regards when you see him again. Tell him I'm still waiting for his written report, which he has declined to give for 6 years here in Santa Cruz.
Okay, well, you take care, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. And that's it for Bathroom Spears, Broadside's Night, except for Crow. Do you have any final cawings before you take off?
I've been a little upset with the person serving food, not bombs, down at the Wednesday market because he is making the food, and I sit around and talk with people, interviewing them without serving it, and people are serving themselves, putting their hands in the food, and so I've been protesting that personally myself.
Well, I suggest you clean up, wash your hands, and step forward as a food server, Crow.
Unfortunately, I've been too busy trying to help other people with broke down vehicles on the side of the highway.
And now that you don't have a vehicle, it's even worse for you. Well, look, let's talk more next time. Sunday, I'll be coming back at 9:30, and I encourage people to check that out. We don't have any particular protest planned for this weekend, but there are issues coming up that need to be attended to, ranging from every night people's property being taken, people being arrested for sleeping or ticketed for sleeping or harassed for sleeping when they have no legal place to go, and other issues concerning discrimination against the homeless. Give me a call if you're interested in fighting those issues or reporting on those issues. 423-4833 is the number to call. Coming up next, Uncle Dennis from the Cream to the Dregs.
He's Hi, Robert.
Here he is. Hey there, Dennis.
I just wanted to speak for a minute about a subject that came up earlier on your show.
Go ahead.
That's the growing of marijuana in national parks and national forests in California and around the West.
Mm-hmm.
It is a real big problem, and mostly because of the habitat destruction that's going on, the polluting of streams, cutting and excluding of native plants, the shooting and maiming of wild animals that come near the marijuana grows. It's not a very pretty industry out there, and it's being done on our national parks and our national forests, and it costs millions of dollars to go in, find these grows, and then clean them up afterwards, some of which have some nasty chemicals involved with them. Unfortunately, there is a very definite association with Mexican nationals and most likely Mexican drug cartels, including the attempted shooting of officers in the woods, places like that, evidence of illegal aliens being brought to California and other places in the western United States to tend these marijuana grows. It all gets down to the bottom reality that we need to legalize marijuana and let people grow in their backyard, and that's probably the fastest and easiest way to get Mexican drug cartels out of California and the West.
And then we have to deal with the pharmaceutical cartels that are even worse than the Mexican drug cartels. But let's not get into that. Thanks for being with me, Dennis. And everybody else, Dennis is going to be with you for the next 3 hours. So listen up. Thanks for being with me. 423-HUFF is the number to call if you want to catch me off air.
Got something queued up here, Robert?
Maybe. Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Uncle Dennis here with you on a Thursday night. Let me get my microphone all set up here after people modulate the modulate the controls in ways that are inscrutable. Anyway, welcome to From the Cream to the Dregs here on a Thursday night. It's good to be here. If you are out in the wild right now, take a look up. At least in Santa Cruz, we have a rather amazing sunset going on. Some high clouds, some very pink reds, and things like that going on. Kind of pretty. Anyway, it was when I was walking into the studio, so hopefully your life is going well. We, of course, are struggling along with life ourselves. So, anyway, hope you can stay tuned for the next 3 hours for From the Cream to the Dregs, where we're going to explore the music of the 60s and the 70s, rock and roll, blues, psychedelic, and beyond. So, anyway, we are done with Woodstock. We did 2 weeks of Woodstock's 40th anniversary the last 2 weeks, and so we're gonna do some moving on here and check things out. Coming up in just a little while, we're going to check out the Brew of the Week, a rather unique and rare ale on tap tonight for the Brew of the Week. Of course, at 9 o'clock, we'll have the Earth First Update, environmental news for you. And then at 10 o'clock, the Spotlight Group of the Week, a whole hour of music from one artist or group right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, www.freakradio.org. Right now, let's go to the Fillmore West, live in 1971, Santana.